Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hi.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual Birthday Spectacular episode.
Number two.
This is for my birthday, people, so I got to pick the topic today. Anyway, we're here to discuss new nerd creations, or in this case, an old nerd creation, how they were made, and explore the roots of those characters and those stories. And today we're talking about the coolest, most amazing science fiction film ever made, ever, period. James Cameron's Aliens. Aliens, plural. That's the sequel, not the 1979 original made by Ridley Scott. So quick synopsis for all you poor, poor, unfortunate souls out there who have not seen Aliens. Honestly, stop listening right now and just go watch it because it's the best thing that'll ever happen to you. Maybe I'm selling it too hard, but it's a great movie. Anyway, quick synopsis. Aliens is the 1986 sequel of the 1979 film Alien. Alien, the first one, is a horror movie directed by Ridley Scott that was lauded in its time as a very deep film with lots of subtext and themes, which I'll get into a little bit later. 1986's Aliens, the sequel, which is what we are talking about today, was directed and written by James Cameron, and it takes off almost immediately after the first film. Aliens follows Sigourney Weaver waking up from hypersleep 57 years after the end of the first movie, as the lone survivor of the first movie's events, which I don't want to get into in case you want to watch it and I don't want to spoil anything. No one back home believes her story of an alien with acid for blood killing her entire crew. This changes, however, when Earth loses contact with a colony that was set up where Ripley's old crew first encountered the alien. Ripley is sent to the planet as a consultant with a squad of space marines to investigate. Aliens stars Sigourney Weaver, Michael Biehn, Bill Paxton, Paul Reiser, Lance Henriksen, Jeanette Goldstein, and Carrie Henn. I will be talking about the history of Aliens, and let me tell you, it's a doozy.
Apparently this is Kyle's opus.
This is my opus. This is my birthday episode. It's my opus. It's my party. And I will talk for 40 minutes if I want to.
I will be talking about nothing, apparently, because this will just be Kyle the whole podcast.
No, I'm actually really excited for your segment, Claire, because I know the production of Aliens and James Cameron and his
wily ways,
yeah, his quote-unquote genius is the stuff of movie-making legend.
Yeah.
Like his fights with the crew there. So I'm excited to hear about this, actually. So let me take it away and get into the history of Aliens. In order to talk about my beloved Aliens, you have to discuss at least a little bit of its predecessor, 1979's Alien, singular. Alien is essentially a haunted house horror movie with a rugged spaceship serving as the haunted house and an alien serving as that, you know, thing that's going around picking off the crew one by one and killing people. What I think really elevates this movie into being better than it should be, which is better than kind of almost a B-horror film, is the art and mind of H.R. Giger, the Swiss surrealist artist that designed The Alien, along with most of the coolest-looking bits of the movie Alien.
We've mentioned him before on the podcast.
We have. We mentioned him in the Ash vs. Evil Dead episode, and you mentioned the Stranger Things one.
Yeah, we don't talk about horror a lot on this podcast, but I feel like whenever we do, Giger comes up.
He's associated, yeah, yeah. Maybe that's just because you don't like horror, and the horror that I like is a little Giger-esque, you know, mm-hmm. and so he's always relevant to whenever we talk about horror.
Okay.
Anyway, Alien might be the most overanalyzed movie ever. There's the amount of, like, bizarre scholarly articles written about this movie is insane, and I wrote down the list of some of the titles here because I just think it's really funny, and I feel like people overanalyze a bit into this movie. Here's just a list of our different articles written about Alien. Woman, the other alien in Alien. Mommy Dearest, Aliens, Rosemary's Baby, and Mothering. Voices of sexual distortion, rape, birth, and self-annihilation metaphors in the Aliens trilogy. Son of a Bitch, Feminism, Humanism, and Science in Alien. And Feminism and Anxiety in Alien.
I just watched Alien for this podcast. I feel like it doesn't quite earn all of that. Maybe that's my uneducated opinion.
I agree with you. I don't think it earns all that either. But I want to get into why I think some people see so much in it. So Scott himself has said that Alien has absolutely no message, quote. And I totally agree. I think what people clue into with this movie is the art and design of H.R. Giger, because Giger did have messages in his art and deeper themes to his art. Now, according to Bloody Disgusting, which is a website dedicated to horror, and it's actually a pretty cool website if you're into horror, Giger's work predominantly features illustrations of the human form coalescing with meticulously envisioned machinery in a multitude of different and oftentimes sexually explicit ways. Torment, pain, and sexual ecstasy seem to be a common theme in Giger's art.
I can see how that is an alien.
Yeah, yeah. And there's and a lot of that, you know, there's a lot of, like, phallic shapes and, like, you know, and just, like, body part inspired monsters and hallways and things in it.
And even how that comes out in the movie as well through the action.
Yeah. You know, there's a whole birth scene quote.
Yeah.
You know, that it's famous for. That's the chest burst.
Having not seen Alien, I knew about the birth scene.
Exactly.
I'd seen parodies of the birth scene.
Exactly. And Giger was originally hired on to Alien to just design the creature, but Scott loved what he was doing and was like, you know what? Just design pretty much everything. He didn't design the human ship, but Giger designed the alien ship, the alien in that ship, you know, who's looking up the so-called space jockey, and just a lot of the whole planet itself, actually, Giger designed.
Good on Ridley Scott. I feel like that is a great decision that he made. And a really interesting one.
Yeah. I think as a director, he's a good manager. He sees good people and helps put them in places to make his movies better than maybe they should be.
That's a talent.
It is a talent. I'm not the biggest Ridley Scott fan, but he does have a good eye for talent, I think. So Giger's works, his art, this really creepy, crazy art, you got to look it up. It's totally mind-boggling. Comes from his nightmares. He took art therapy to deal with night terrors that he had, and he started just drawing his nightmares. So the aliens and the designs in Alien and the Alien franchise are literally someone's nightmares.
That's intense.
It's intense, and it's so otherworldly. It's what really elevates the Alien film into being better than it is.
Oh, wow, that's a lot to think about, too, with how scary it is.
Exactly, exactly. So I believe a lot of those, like, you know, feminist, phallic-centered sexual themes of rape and penetration and the anxiety of males and a post-feminist whatever were not themes inserted by Scott, but were kind of carried into this film via Giger's hands and Giger's design. Like, they weren't intended to be there. They were there because Giger's hands were on it, and that's in his art. And the reason I want to establish that is because that's one of the big differences I think there are between Alien and Aliens. I think Aliens is much better than Alien because Ridley Scott had no message in Alien, and I think James Cameron certainly had some themes and messages he was trying to push with that movie.
Yeah, he certainly did.
Which I'm excited to find out more about in your segment. So I'm going to switch gears here and go into Aliens, the one that I love that we are here to talk about. One of the big differences often cited between Alien and Aliens is the very military and martial feel of Aliens. In the first movie, you follow a working-class-looking crew just trying to survive on their ship. Then Aliens comes along and dials up the action by showing you these creatures through the eyes of Marines. I've read that James Cameron was reading Robert Heinlein around the time he was writing the script for Aliens, and that he would listen to Holst's Mars Bringer of War.
That was in my segment, too.
Was it?
I was like, oh, this is our song, Kyle.
I know.
We both love that.
I wasn't sure how true either of those statements are, but it's cool that they're validated. Because that
maybe
is
we
awesome.
Read the same article.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
I read that as well. And I know that Holst is one of Kyle's favorite composers,
yeah.
And then that James Cameron was listening to Holst while he was writing Kyle's favorite film.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It was like, oh, this is all Kyle, all the time.
Well, and the James Horner soundtrack, James Horner's the composer who wrote the soundtrack for Aliens, really resembles Holst a lot. I listened to the soundtrack over the weekend, and I was like, yeah, you were listening to Holst, and you were telling your composer, like, just make it Mars, but a little different. But so whether or not all that stuff is true, it can't be denied. Military science fiction definitely plays a role in Aliens. Now, James Cameron dropped a lot of the phallic/violent penetration sexual imagery of the first movie in favor of a much more martial and military subtext.
Which I enjoyed so much more.
Yeah, me too. There are these long and detailed shots of guns and weapons, and the ship that the Marines arrive on resembles a giant rifle of some kind even.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron is even has a whole scene explaining how the pulse rifle, which is kind of the main gun in the movie, works. And this martial feel is something right out of the military sci-fi subgenre, whose most famous author, Robert Heinlein, Cameron was supposedly reading while working on this script. Now, Robert Heinlein didn't invent the genre, but he is probably the biggest name in it, and his most famous military sci-fi novel is Starship Troopers, which was published in 1959. And just for real quick, military sci-fi is a subgenre of science fiction that focuses on military tech, strategy, or policy, and it's actually more prevalent than you realize. You've probably read a military sci-fi book, Claire.
Yeah. No, I have. I think also Cameron, especially in films, helped popularize movie sci-fi.
Yeah.
This is Aliens is given a lot of credit for that.
For pushing military sci-fi.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that later as well. And that he made it so popular that now, especially in video games, it's just become the norm.
Yeah, yeah. No, with these like weird future weapons and stuff
right.
like that.
And the idea of the unit working together.
Yeah. And if you guys think you've never read a military sci-fi book, if you were forced to read Ender's Game, it's a great book. If you're forced to read Ender's Game in school, you've read a military sci-fi novel. That is Orson Scott Card's, you know, very famous book about kids fighting space aliens. The funny thing is that Aliens hardly resembles Starship Troopers or Robert Heinlein books at all. Starship Troopers, just as an example, is extremely militaristic and revels a lot in the quote-unquote glory of war. Its harshest critics have labeled it fascist propaganda, which I don't agree with. I haven't read it since I was probably 15, so I'm not sure how well it holds up over time, but I don't think it's fascist propaganda. but it is undoubtedly very, very pro-military, which to me is a far cry from the somewhat cynical military portrayal in Aliens. Aliens.
I don't think it was anti-military, though.
I don't think Aliens was anti-military either, but it's not 100% gung-ho pro-military in that your commander in Aliens is incompetent. There's incompetent leadership for this group of Marines. And the grunts, who, while fighting valiantly, lose to an enemy despite having far superior firepower and technology mm-hmm. to that enemy. The military sci-fi book that I think really reflects some of the themes of Aliens well is Joe Haldeman's masterpiece, The Forever War, which came out in 1974.
Have you read that?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I read it about 8 years ago, and I've always wanted to go back to it and reread it, but it's a really, really good book, and I feel like it lines up really well with Aliens and a lot of the themes in it. So Forever War follows a future interstellar war that pits humanity against an alien race known as the Torrens. Forever War deals with the randomness and sometimes futility of armed conflict and does quite the opposite of reveling in the glory of war. It's very cynical and against it. And people say it was written as a response to Robert Heinlein, but Joe Haldeman denies that. And one of the big conflicts in Forever War is actually somewhat touched upon right from the get-go in Aliens. In Forever War, Mandela, the protagonist, has to travel 100 light years from Earth to fight a battle. So when he returns to Earth, he has hardly aged, and Earth has seen 100 years go by. His home has become a foreign land, and the society there largely ostracizes him. His family and friends are long gone, and the only people who really understand what he's going through are other soldiers.
Oh, that is the plot of Aliens.
Which is exactly, that's one of the main motivations in the beginning of Aliens for Ripley going to this planet, where she doesn't want to go, and she's kind of suffering from PTSD from what happened to her in the first movie. But 60 years have passed, and she doesn't know anyone anymore, you know, mm-hmm. her daughter has passed away.
What else is she really to do?
Exactly, yeah. And so I thought there's definitely some good parallels between Aliens and Forever War, especially out of the military sci-fi genre. Real quick, Haldeman modeled Forever War after his own experience of being drafted into the Vietnam War and serving in combat. And James Cameron has mentioned in interviews that with Aliens, he was trying to capture elements of the Vietnam War and imbue them into his military vision in the movie. And this helps explain the kind of inept command of Gorman and the idea of a technologically inferior enemy defeating soldiers with far superior weaponry.
When you watch Aliens, you can't help but think of Vietnam.
Exactly.
Especially, like, the feel of it, maybe because it's an 80s movie, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It just feels like a Vietnam movie.
It does, with like the wisecracking Marines and mm-hmm. stuff. So now I'm going to switch gears away from military sci-fi, and I want to move on to actual human space travel. Mm-hmm. this leads me to my final point, feminism!
Yay!
Yay!
My mom is so proud of you right
good,
now.
Good. Well, there's definitely a lot of feminist tones in Aliens. The fact that when you know, crap hits the fan, it is a woman who takes over, the lack of sexualization of the said woman in the movie, and the whole theme of, like, these strong mothers. I think a lot can be said about the fact that the movie pits Ripley, the adopted mother of this young girl named Newt, against the queen alien, mother of all the other aliens. A lot can be said, but you'll have to hear that somewhere else. Because I honestly feel it can be a little hypocritical for, like, some dude to give this huge feminist lecture about, like, themes in Aliens. But just know that it is a feminist film, and it's a wonderful film. However, what I will talk about is the parallels between Sigourney Weaver's Ripley flying through space and the triumph of women in the 80s achieving spaceflight in this country for the first time. So let me start by saying that the astronaut program in the 60s and 70s and NASA in general was extremely sexist.
Really?
I actually just read a book on this called Apollo and the Age of Aquarius about...
It doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah. When I say really, that's sarcastic.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
People were sexist in the 60s?
People were sexist in the 60s. People who I looked up to, and when I read quotes of, I was like, oh, no. Why would you say that, you supposedly American hero? So women were not expressly forbidden from the astronaut program in the 60s and 70s. But to be an astronaut, NASA insisted that one have at least 1,500 hours of flying time as a qualified jet pilot.
Okay.
Seeing as the Women's Armed Services Integration Act of 1948 banned them, women that is, from the cockpits of combat planes, including jet fighters, this was impossible. So it wasn't that women weren't allowed to be astronauts.
They didn't even need to allow them.
They were just never allowed to even try and qualify to be astronauts. Not only that, but there were numerous other sexist forces working in NASA that made it unlikely that women would ever achieve the astronaut program. And I have some really sad quotes from some people that I have always looked up to here. NASA rocket scientist Wernher von Braun had this to say about women in the space program when he was given a talk in 1962 at Mississippi State College. Von Braun says, "All I can say is the male astronauts are all for it, reserving 110 pounds of payload for recreational equipment."
I don't get it.
So 110 pounds of payload, which is like you're calculating all the weight you take up into space and what can be blasted into space. 110 pounds of payload being a woman for recreational equipment.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa. Granted, wow, you could say that.
You could say that at a college, and people laughed and guffawed.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
And the Washington Post echoed this sentiment in an article in 1968 entitled Women's Place in Outer Space. "The question of man's sexual needs on flights has to be considered."
You forget. I forget. I wasn't there. But you forget how bad it was.
This last one makes me the most sad. Because Wernher von Braun was a great scientist, and I always thought he was cool. But what he said is completely terrible. And I also, you have to remember, he was also a Nazi scientist that we stole. So it's like,
He was a Nazi.
He was a former Nazi. But American hero and astronaut John Glenn got in on these terrible comments on record, saying about women in the space program that we would welcome them with open arms, so to speak. John Glenn! The Boy Scout of America!
Yeah, I guess it was just, that's how you talked. I think it was way more accepted.
That's so sad.
Just boys being boys, Kyle.
No, it's so messed up.
No, it is.
Yeah.
I need to go on record saying I do not agree with that at all.
So needless to say that if you were a little girl in the 60s and 70s, the only chance you would ever have to go to space, if you really wanted to go to space, would be to go as a whore, which is so depressing. And you know what makes it even worse is that this is in America. The Soviets in 1963 put the first woman in space ever, Valentina Tereshkova.
Good for the Soviets.
And when they brought her back down, they were like, see, in Soviet Russia and communism, men and women are equal. And it's like, wow, man, the Soviets are putting women in space, and we're talking about how the only way they're going to get there is if they're going to have sex with the astronauts at the same time. It was depressing. But
was it a big deal at the time?
That Tereshkova went to space?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a huge deal. Because NASA kept saying that women's bodies couldn't handle space. And then the Soviets sent Tereshkova into space in 1963, and she did more space hours than all of the American astronauts combined.
Oh, good for her.
And it was like, ooh, I wouldn't want to be
in Soviet Russia, yeah. But good for Soviet Russia.
Yeah. So feminists in the 1970s fought against this attitude, and eventually in 1979, the same year that the first Alien movie was released, showing women working in space, women were allowed to qualify for the astronaut program. And it was in 1983 that Sally Ride, an American physicist, became the first American woman in space. And she is also the youngest American to ever go to space, having been 32 on her first Challenger mission.
Whoa, why was she picked?
Because she was the best person for the job. And during her publicity, the publicity tour that Ride was sent on, as, you know, the first woman in space, first American woman in space, she constantly insisted to the press that she was just one of the guys, quote unquote, and her fellow crew members insisted that as well, saying that she was there on merit. They were like, look, we're not just trying to send a woman to space. It's that the astronaut program was open to women in 79, and that she was the best person in that group of astronauts, that astronaut class.
Do you believe that?
I do. She was an accomplished physicist, and she worked in Southern California with robotics a lot, and part of this mission was using a robotic arm to capture satellites, and she was just the best at using and controlling that robotic arm. Now, I want to tell this story about roses. When the Challenger landed and the astronauts got out, and there was like a big press thing there, and there was a stage, and the astronauts stood on the stage, NASA sent an official up with a bunch of roses for Sally Ride. And Sally Ride looked at that official and shook her head no. And the official came forward anyway and tried to give her these roses, and she turned her back on this official. She basically was saying that I don't want to be treated like differently from everyone else. Unless you have flowers for all of my fellow crewmates, then don't give me flowers. And I feel as though what Sally Ride wanted was to be treated the way that Ripley and Vasquez are treated in the film Aliens. No attention is brought to them for being women. They are all there to do their job and complete their mission. And that is the end of my segment. And thank you all for bearing with me.
It was super interesting, Kyle. And I can't wait to go back talking about the women in the film.
Because
it's very impressive and then sad that it's impressive.
Yeah, I agree.
So I guess I'll just continue. Kyle, you kind of took little bits and pieces from what I was going to talk about, too. So stop me if I start going into something you've already said. So this Aliens came out 7 years after Alien, which I think you mentioned, and it cost $18 million to make, which is a very small budget now, but it's a very small budget even for back then. Just to give you an idea, I know there's inflation involved in this as well, but another sci-fi sequel that was just made was Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and that was made for $170 million.
Which is quite a pretty penny.
Right, right. And, I mean, obviously, inflation, and it has the Marvel studio behind it. But that's just an idea of what it costs to make an action sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
Aliens was Cameron's first big Hollywood studio film. It was his third time directing a feature film. His other films were Piranha 2, The Spawning, and a little-known film. Have you heard of it? It's called The Terminator?
I've never heard of that. Terminator? It sounds Austrian, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. I think it might be. I want to give a little background on James Cameron, because this film could not have happened without this director. Cameron originally studied physics, but then he decided he wanted to pursue his dream of making films, actually drove a truck for a little while to make ends meet. He eventually made his first short. It was a sci-fi film called Exogenesis, and that got him a job with New World Pictures, run by Roger Corman, who is a very famous B-movie director. Some of his more famous films are The Trip and The Intruder. He's done so much. It's really worth going and checking out what he's done, because it's so impressive.
And there, Roger Corman, when he's a B-film director, he makes a solid B-film. You know, it's not garbage. It's like a movie that you can sit down and there can't be parts, but it's generally well done, I feel like.
He's a bit of a legend in his own right.
Yeah.
Cameron did a ton of different jobs working at New World Pictures and eventually directed his first feature, Piranha 2, The Spawning, which didn't do particularly well.
Oh, no? I thought I...
No. I don't know why.
Riding the Jaws wave, I imagine.
Probably. He wrote Terminator, and it actually took him 2 years to find a production company that would not only produce it, but let him direct it as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so all of this, his writing of Terminator, working at New World Pictures, was happening when Alien came out. And Cameron said he was stunned by Alien, along with the rest of the world. And he wanted to make a second one because he was so impressed by the creatures that Ridley Scott created.
H.R. Giger created.
Yes. He credits Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
Fox was originally planning on doing a sequel, but the thing is, it wasn't 2017. Sequels weren't the common thing to be doing back then. And right around when they were talking about doing a sequel, a change in management happened. And then the new management didn't want to do a sequel. So the people who wanted to do the sequel had to wait for that management to leave. And then after that turnover, the new management was interested in doing the sequel.
That's why it took 7 years, I guess, which mm-hmm. is a long time.
Well, nowadays, if Alien came out and did that well, the sequel would be out 2 years later. But it wasn't how it was done.
The sequel would have already been filmed.
Yeah. The script would have been ready, the finger on the button, ready to go.
Exactly.
The reason Cameron got to write the script was because the producers at Fox really liked his script for Terminator, for good reason. It's a great film. Now, Cameron had to wait to shoot Terminator because Arnold Schwarzenegger, by the way.
Austrian, by the way.
was contracted to film Conan the Barbarian, and that film came up and they had to push back the Terminator shoot.
Which is a great film in its own right too, Conan the Barbarian.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
It's a little ridiculous, but it's cool.
I assume it is. I kind of assume that anything Arnold does is a little bit ridiculous.
It's that accent. You can't help but you can't help but make fun of it.
You do it so well, Kyle.
Thank you, Claire.
I think you should do the rest of the podcast in that accent.
Okay.
So Cameron had all this time on his hands, and so he got to take on writing Alien 2. He wrote the treatment for Aliens, I think, in about 90 days. And like you said, he listened to Holtz, and he was inspired by Robert A. Heinlein, Isaac Asimov. And he was also inspired by the Vietnam War film Southern Comfort.
Yeah, which I've never seen,
actually.
Me
neither, no. And he didn't actually have the whole script written by the time he had to film Terminator, but the Fox executives loved what he had and agreed to wait for him to finish the script. They also said that if Terminator turned out well, they would let him direct it. And Gail Ann Hurd, who was his wife at the time and the producer on Aliens and Terminator, said that that was unheard of,
that the
studio would just wait for you.
Yeah.
But they did, and they kept their word. Cameron, when taking on the script, was very firm that he was doing a sequel and not a remake. And he wanted to take what he was personally interested in from the first Alien, which was the alien life cycle, and Ripley, which was Sigourney Weaver's character.
Yeah.
And he wanted to use that to explore a different part of sci-fi. And what he was interested in, that what you touched on, was the idea of military in the future, because he felt that that hadn't really been realized on screen before. So part of this was that he had to get Sigourney Weaver to sign on. And Sigourney Weaver said she was interested as soon as she read the script. And she apparently had turned down other Alien 2 scripts because she didn't think they did her character well.
Yeah.
But she felt that he really fleshed out Ripley. And she also liked that Cameron took her notes on certain things of how the character would react in certain situations. And I think that's really cool.
That she was able
to say, no, in this little segment here, she would do this, not this. And he was like, oh, okay. Now, speaking of feminism and women getting what they want, Fox didn't want to pay Weaver the money she was asking for. And they actually asked Cameron to do a version of Aliens without her.
Really?
He said he couldn't do it. So they paid Sigourney exactly what she asked for, which was $1 million.
Say what you will about the man, James Cameron, but he stands by. He likes strong, accomplished, capable women.
Yeah, and this is an issue in Hollywood now. You heard about Jennifer Lawrence getting paid way less than Bradley Cooper.
That's true.
Really cool to hear that Sigourney Weaver asked for this money and got this
and got
money.
It, yeah.
She was a star at the time.
Yeah.
But
still.
And she deserved it,
exactly.
Obviously.
Yeah.
This movie is amazing, and she's amazing in it. And something I did know about Alien, by the way, was that the filming process was not smooth.
It's notoriously not smooth.
Yeah. So I want to talk about that as well. It was filmed in England at Pinewood Studios. Now, Cameron is not British.
He's Canadian.
He's Canadian. And he is a notoriously demanding director. Kyle, can you tell me the joke that you told me earlier this week?
I have an uncle in film school, and he said there's an old film school joke, which is a film student dies and goes to heaven, and angels showing him around heaven. And film school walks by this alley, and there's a movie being filmed. And he looks down that alley. He's like, oh my gosh, James Cameron's directing this film up here? James Cameron's dead? And the angel looks at him and goes, no, 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 that's God. He just thinks he's James Cameron. it's one of my favorite jokes.
Yeah, but from all I've heard of James Cameron, that's
accurate.
It's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
And a lot of the British crew didn't like him. So here's the thing, especially at this point in his career where he was new. Because of his time at New World Pictures, the B-movie studio he worked at, he knew all of the tech stuff that was going on. So the crew couldn't pull the wool over his eyes.
He'd done every job.
He'd done every job, except acting. Yeah. And the actors said in interviews they were lucky because he didn't know anything about acting. I've heard this process referred to as a culture clash. This young, dynamic Canadian director who knew exactly what he wanted and could have gotten exactly what he wanted if there were 100 of him, going up against a British crew who weren't invested in the vision the way he was. The crew, a lot of them had worked on the first Alien movie, and they were huge Ridley Scott fans.
Which, I don't understand.
No, if you worked on that movie and it did as well
yeah,
as it did,
true,
you'd be so proud of it.
Yeah.
They hadn't seen Terminator, so they didn't really have faith in Cameron's talent. And Cameron would try and get them involved and have showings of the daily footage, or dailies, as they're referred to in the film world.
Yeah.
But apparently none of the crew would go. And also, in the U.S., they didn't have tea breaks, which were union regulated in England. And Cameron would be so upset by these tea breaks because he felt they always happened right when things were starting to get going. And supposedly, he turned over more than one tea cart.
That's hilarious.
And also, I read that this was kind of the European way of making a movie. Longer lunches, longer breaks. And Cameron was under time and budget constraints. They had a release date for this movie going into production.
Oh,
so
wow.
They knew when it was coming out. And
yeah.
they didn't have a ton of time. Cameron was at war to finish this war movie.
It's a Canadian you don't want to cross,
you
is James Cameron.
Don't. Well, despite all of the production problems, and there were a lot, like the composer was writing the score days before they had to send it in.
I'd heard about that.
Yeah. Aliens was a hit with audiences and critics alike. Even fans of the original Alien liked it. And if you look at it now on Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 98% critic score, which I think is the highest critic score of anything we've talked about on this podcast.
Yeah, it's insanely high.
And an 93% audience score.
Especially for something that's been out for a long time. Sometimes you'll see that score on movies that only have like 5-10 reviewers.
This has everyone's reviewed.
Reviewed Aliens.
Yeah. A week after it came out, Aliens made the cover of Time magazine. Aliens made $131 million worldwide. Remember, it was made for $18
million. Pretty good.
The studio definitely recouped its investment. Audience and critics actually complained about physical discomfort and illness when leaving the theater. I saw it described as being locked in an all-consuming sense of peril, which was Cameron's goal. He wanted to emphasize the terror, not necessarily the horror, like the first movie did.
Yeah.
It also earned 7 Oscar nominations. It was nominated for Best Sound, Best Film Editing, Best Art Direction / Set Direction, Best Music. It won for Best Sound Effects Editing and Best Visual Effects. And Sigourney Weaver actually got an Oscar nomination for it, which was the first time a sci-fi action film got a nomination for acting.
I had never heard that until recently, actually. And I love this movie. And I was so shocked that, like, but it makes sense because she crushes it in
yeah,
this movie.
It's
hard to deny.
It's a Best Supporting Actress nod, which is crazy. It should be a Best Actress nod.
Yeah, that is weird.
And they maybe thought she would actually get nominated if they submitted her in that category.
Yeah.
As far as how it holds up over time, it's acknowledged as one of the best action movies of all time. If you Google best action movies, Aliens is on almost every list. It's also said that it's one of the best sequels of all time, and it's what other sequels should aspire to. Again, Google best sequels, guarantee
Aliens.
You, Aliens is on that list. And what people say about this as a sequel is it got bigger and it went in a different direction, but it remained faithful to the source. People often call it the perfect sequel. And I've read multiple articles saying that filmmakers still to this day don't take lessons from Aliens and how to make a sequel, because they still are copying the formula of the first one when they make sequels.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, we loved Guardians of the Galaxy. But if you watch most sequels today, they're just copying the original and not trying to do something different with the same material
or kind of
continue the story in a different fashion.
Definitely.
Some of the tropes that it's credited with starting, the trope of the wisecracking space marines, which we talked about earlier, and especially in video games.
Yeah,
this has
yeah.
just become so common.
And you see it in Halo a lot.
Mm-hmm. I don't think Halo would be the same thing without Aliens.
It's not. They take their weapons from Aliens, too, in Halo.
Oh, that totally makes sense. Yeah. I also read that the cliche of a crew of grunts who get picked off one by one was something that Aliens made popular. But it's something that Alien made popular as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The two of them for that. And what you talked about earlier with feminism, that's what this film gets the most credit for, and rightly so. Aliens pretty much defined the female action hero, and it was kind of the first female action hero. You could say Foxy Brown in the 70s film Foxy Brown was kind of the first female action hero, but Aliens is right there on the list too. In a Guardian article that I read, Zan Brooks talks about how Ripley advanced the movie heroine and that the entertainment industry would be very different without her. He believes that there would be no Buffy and that Bond girls were actually toughened up because of her. And the first Bond movie released after Aliens, called The Living Daylights, had the female lead running around with a crossbow, which just hadn't happened before. And Ripley is what all other female action heroes are compared to now. Whenever you talk about the female action hero or you mention Katniss or Furiosa from Mad Max, they usually refer to Ripley as well. And I didn't know that. I didn't realize she was the first. And then when you look at other movies from before Aliens, there's no one like her. James, our producer, was saying that Leia is a bit of an action hero, but she's not the action hero.
I love Star Wars as not as much as the next guy, but she's no Ripley.
So this is our opinion segment. And Kyle, I can't tell. Do you like this movie?
You can tell, Claire. I picked this for my birthday episode. I found out it's my number one favorite movie ever of all time. I think it's the best movie ever made. James and Claire, James the producer, had not seen it. And I was like, look, we got to do this. We're going to sit down. We're going to watch Aliens. And we watched the first one as well. You guys watched it separately.
Yeah. You know, I was very ashamed that I hadn't seen it. But also, as a kid, my parents and my brother can all testify to this. I had such a crazy imagination. And that's part of the reason I don't like horror, is that I would get so scared, just crazy nightmares. So a big reason why I didn't see Aliens is because it was so terrifying. It is terrifying.
It is.
I mean, you saw me watching it. hiding under pillows.
James Cameron does such a good job in this movie keeping the tension. Like, once the tension starts, it doesn't stop. You are constantly afraid for the lives of these people, and you care about these people.
Yeah. Oh, he does such a good job at creating the individual characters. So even though it's a huge group of Marines, you feel like you understand the different type of people who were there, and you know who they are personally.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that Alien, the first one, suffered from, in my opinion, and I feel like maybe it's why some other people don't like it, is that it's a horror movie, so they force the characters to make those dumb horror movie decisions where you're like, wait, why would you do that? Don't do that, because they're forced in these situations where these people need to die.
Don't go off by yourself and look for that cat.
Yeah, that's a big part of in Alien. There's a cat on the ship, and it's constantly like, oh, well, you know, there's a murderous alien running around, but we can't find the cat. So if you could go off into the dark, scary portion of the ship by yourself to find the cat, that would be lovely.
I would not have gone by myself to look for the cat. I just want to state that.
Yeah.
You would have had to walk with me.
At arm to the teeth.
I know, probably dragging me.
Exactly. And in Aliens, you may not disagree with, or you may disagree with some of the decisions people make, but you understand where they're coming from when they make decisions. When you're like, why would Ripley ever go back to that planet after what she experienced? Oh, I see why. Like, she's trying to face her demons. She has nothing to lose because her family's gone. You know, there's a lot here. Like, maybe I wouldn't do it, but I understand why she would.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I feel like there's less bad decisions in Aliens. You understand where people are coming from.
I was so surprised by how positive critics were about Alien.
Me too, a little bit.
I know we're not talking about Alien, it's Aliens, but it was something reading criticism about Aliens and then, you know, you read criticism about Alien just in conjunction with it. People, critics, and very intelligent critics love it, and it made me feel like I was really missing something there.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of cool themes in Alien that are left open-ended that make you want to wonder. Because mm-hmm. in Alien, they find this alien in this crashed ship on this planet with the skeleton of an even larger, weirder-looking alien sitting in the ship, and they don't know what's going on. So, like, there are things like, oh, what else is out there? And we're kind mm-hmm. of insignificant in the universe. But in the end, it's kind of like a barely better than B-horror film,
yeah.
I think.
And I don't like horror, so that contributes yeah. to it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also, the Cameron's female superheroes are so cool. And we were just talking about this in my segment, but I just think it's so awesome that he, for as difficult and as hard as he is to work with, and apparently as hard as he is to be married to.
Yeah, he's been married a bunch of times to all very strong, competent women.
Right, so he's attracted to strong women, but that he wrote these very powerful women at a time when they weren't being written that
yeah,
way.
Yeah.
Also, in Terminator, Linda Hamilton's character,
Sarah Connor. Yeah.
She's a strong, especially in the second one, she comes back so strong.
Yeah.
And just reading the history of women in superhero movies, superhero action movies.
Yeah.
We have them because of James Cameron.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I still feel like I love Fury Road and Furiosa, and you can see Charlize Theron kind of modeling herself, I think, after Sigourney Weaver in Alien 3. If you ever see Alien 3?
I haven't seen Alien 3.
There are some similarities there.
Right. Well, I would think if you're a female action hero, you kind of are being modeled off of Ripley no matter what.
This is true. And I just feel like no one's done it as well. Even like the Underworld movies with Kate Beckinsale, it's like, yeah, she's really powerful, but we're going to put her in this super tight leather thing. We're going to see her ass all the time, mm-hmm. and she's going to be flipping around. And it's like, it's not this powerful competence of just a human woman that Ripley is. It's like this kind of sexualized, but she kicks ass, but it's still pretty sexualized. And Sigourney Weaver in Aliens is not at all.
No, I mean, she's attractive.
She's
attractive. A minor love interest.
Yeah, she has there's a minor love story, but it's not
barely a love story.
And it's barely a love story.
How cool would it have been to watch this in theaters in 1986?
It's one of the biggest regrets of my life that I never
that
got
you
to see it.
Born
I wasn't born.
1986. Well, Kyle, thank you for introducing me to this. I'm really happy that I finally saw it.
Claire, you're welcome. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. We would love it like I would love a freaking awesome flamethrower that they have in Aliens, which are hard to get on the market these days.
Yeah, especially in New York City.
Yeah, it's gun laws. Anyway. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's K-L-E-X 303.
I can be found at Along With Claire. That's C-L-A-I-R-E.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R. You can learn more about Aliens on our Facebook page, where we're going to post some of our show notes. And there's a lot of information on Aliens out there.
Yeah, and you can tell us what you think of Aliens. Or you can wish Kyle happy birthday. Happy birthday, Kyle.
Thanks, Claire. Woo, happy birthday to me.
Gemini.
Yeah, for anyone listening who liked Alien more than Aliens, please, if you feel so inclined, comment and tell me why. Because I literally don't understand it. And I would love to hear someone's opinion on Alien and Aliens, especially if it differs with mine, just to, you know, see where someone else is coming from. Our producer, who loves to be hugged in the face by weird, creepy spider hand aliens, is James Fowey. He loves that, Claire. I don't know if he ever told you, but he told me in confidence. And I'm not telling anyone. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who, much like Sigourney Weaver, negotiated a crazy contract to do the artwork for this podcast. Like, It's not $1 million, but it's about $1 million. And our theme was composed by the Queen Alien himself, Pete Rowan. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you in 1 week for our special birthday month of June, where we will be discussing Wonder Woman.